You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to RA Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 4th of March, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. And I'm joined today by criminal mastermind, Alex Davies. Alex, how are you doing today?
Hello, everyone. I'm very well, thank you. All things considered.
Of course, I'm referring to the allegations made in the Hope Not Hate magazine, which we're going to be getting onto today. But first, I mean, really, we should mention the weather. We've had freezing cold weather over here in Britain. It's the first time in quite a while that we've had this much snow. And in the south of Britain, in Cornwall, all the white people have been out helping white people. They've been going out to the main roads, bringing out flasks of tea, helping to free the cars. People have been out in their tractors, taking nurses to work, taking doctors to work. And over in Ireland, we had a group of Negroes looting a supermarket, taking advantage of the snow. And I believe before they looted the supermarket, a JCB was stolen and smashed the supermarket up and took the safe out. And I believe that was the Irish Travellers. Obviously, Negroes haven't got the brains to work that out. But once the supermarket was open, that was it. It was Negro looting time. And I think that really, you know, it really shows the difference between white people and black people. You know, a tragedy like that happens. Well, you know, an emergency like that happens. White people go and help. Negroes go out and loot and rob.
Well, you know, you might say that, Sven. I would say it just shows the superior entrepreneurial spirit of the black man.
Well, they do like to think of themselves as entrepreneurs, don't they? That's what these rappers call themselves. But the weather's getting better now, anyway. Yeah. Weather's getting better. It's warming up, and we've got a hot podcast for you today. As I said, we're going to be talking about this Hope Not Hate magazine, and we should really go into the background to this coming out, this Hope Not Hate report coming out, because on Monday last week we had our first story here, which is linked to the Hope Not Hate report, and this is a counter-terrorism chief warns threat of far-right groups is significant and concerning. The outgoing head of counter-terrorism policing in the UK has used his valedictory speech to warn against the rise of the far right, as he revealed four extremist right-wing plots were thwarted in 2017. Now, is he referring to the banning of groups like National Action, who were never convicted of any violent crime, because they banned two other groups as well last year? Or is he referring to the ongoing cases against nationalists, which are basically just accusing them of being members? Does that count as an extreme right-wing plot? He makes mention of Ethan Stables in his speech, who was not a member of any group, but threatened to attack a pub full of poofters. Continuing with the article, aside from the attempted gay pride attack in Barrow, the other three alleged plots that were foiled last year are yet to come to trial. So it's actually one plot that was foiled last year, and it wasn't a far-right group at all. It was just this one loner, Ethan Stables. And then continuing, it says, one allegedly involved a neo-Nazi buying a machete with the intention of murdering the Labour MP Rosie Cooper. And that case relies upon information obtained by a Hope Not Hate spy while a group of young nationalists were drunk in a pub. And that one has yet to actually come to trial. In a conference with journalists before the speech, Rowley said the far-right terror threat was significant and concerning, and the public should be gravely concerned by the existence of National Action, the white supremacist neo-Nazi group banned under terror legislation. Well, they don't exist anymore. That's the whole point. The right-wing threat was not previously organised, he says. Every now and then there's been an individual motivated by that rhetoric who has committed a terrorist act, but we've not had an organised right-wing threat like we do now. he said. He said a third of referrals to the government's prevent strategy aimed at reducing radicalization in communities are now individuals engaged with far-right terrorism. And then he says 10 conspiracies of an Islamist nature were stopped since the Westminster attack. That's just since the Westminster terror attack. There's been 10 Islamic conspiracies. And he says, and I can tell you today that over the same period, police have been able to prevent a further 4 extreme right-wing inspired plots in the UK. He then said, it was important we make these figures public in order to illustrate the growth of right-wing extremism. Not the growth of Islamic terrorism, of which 10 conspiracies were stopped just since the Westminster attack, but it's important that we illustrate the growth of right-wing extremism. And so far, there's just been one individual loner. And yet he thinks this somehow, this is to do with international networks. He says, referring to the banned group National Action, for the first time, we have a homegrown, proscribed, white supremacist, neo-Nazi terror group, which seeks to plan attacks and build international networks. But there's no evidence for that whatsoever. What there is evidence for is Islamic conspiracies, and there's evidence of the government trying to whip up a hysteria and pretend that there's this organization, National Action, which is still around, which it clearly isn't. And at the same time as this week, as he's saying all of this, this Hope Not Hate report has come out, which appears to be, it all appears to have been planned to coincide with this. So we're seeing this terror chief making his valedictory speech, trying to whip up a hysteria. He's been in all the newspapers saying this, saying, oh, we've got to be terrified of the far right, even while admitting that there were 10 attacks, Islamic attacks, that he's not interested in. At the same time, we've got Hope Not Hate, which is saying the same thing. What are your views on this, Alex, before we continue with some more of the things that Mark Rowley has said?
Well, I think they're trying to paint a picture here. They're trying to create a narrative of basically a phantom menace. They want people to believe that there is this big far-right bogeyman who's going around bombing people, killing people, creating all kinds of terror and mischief and doing all sorts of terrible things. But when you look at the empirical evidence doesn't actually show this. You know, you can just see it in what he talks about. You know, 4 failed far-right plots over a 12-month period. Well, that's not a lot. That's 1 every 3 months. And we look at the nature of these plots. They're lone individuals. They're people who are not planning large-scale attacks. They're people very often who are dysfunctional and are simply unable to, even if they wanted to, actually carry out any kind of, you know, terrorist attack, because they're just dysfunctional individuals. They're failures, a lot of them. You know, if you want to look at something like Darren Osborne, you know, even though he had a violent past and all of this, what do you think he could do? The best he could do was hire a van. You know, he didn't have the brains to think of anything more intelligent or anything more sophisticated. But then you look at our Islamic friends, the people who, you know, are meant to be all peace and love. Well, look at, you know, first off, the number of 4 terrorist attacks is 2.5 times greater than that of the far right. That's a significant difference, a significant numerical difference. And then secondly, look at the ambitious nature of their attacks, of their plots. Remember before Christmas, there was that couple that was sent down, and what they were planning on doing was they were planning on putting poison in our food. The guy had actually gotten a job in a factory that, you know, makes prepackaged sandwiches or whatever, and his plan was to go and poison hundreds of these sandwiches. You can imagine the effect that would have had. You could imagine the death toll that would have resulted if he'd even done half of what he was planning on doing. And that's the crucial difference. And that's why this kind of this bolstering, this kind of talking up of the far right threat isn't a genuine kind of isn't a genuine analysis of the threat. But what it is, it's a way to, I think, coax people into living in fear. And it's a way of people of putting people in a box where they think, right, you've got this far right threat and you've got this Islamist threat, and the only people we can turn to are the government. And in reality, the government caused these problems by inviting these immigrants here, and secondly, they are not our friends because they are displacing us and they criminalize any kind of dissent. So that's what's happening here. I think there's this talking up of this far-right phantom menace, and it's all done for ideological reasons.
Yeah, it's the real significance is the Islamic attacks, and those weren't over the whole year either. That was just since the Westminster attack that there have been 10 plots that were foiled. The supposed far right plots, there was only 4 of them, and none of them have been linked to any organisation. And there's only been one that's come to trial, and that was this Ethan Stable. So really, there's only been one plot that was one loner, the same as Darren Osborne. As you say, he was an alcoholic, he had a terrible criminal record, and he was just acting out of frustration at what he saw.
Well, all of these people, Darren Osborne, there's a Polish bloke as well that's been mentioned, and there's another guy at the moment called Connor Ward in Scotland who's going through the courts at the moment. He's the bloke with like 2,000 RAC songs on his hard drive, and they were trying to make a big deal out of that. Now he's going through the court system. But you look at all of these people, they're not ordinary people. You go to your average kind of nationalist meeting and you do meet some eccentrics, let's be honest. But you meet a lot of ordinary people, a lot of people who, you know, you could meet anywhere. You know, you could meet in down your local Royal British Legion club, you know, or your local working men's club. But you look at these people, the people who carry out these, you know, who carry out these supposed attacks, Tommy Mayer, Darren Osborne. Ethan Stables was apparently a bisexual. You know what I mean? These people, they're weird and they're dysfunctional and they've got these problems. So that even if they try to get involved in the organised far right or the organised nationalist movement, they wouldn't fit in because even by our standards, they're just too weird.
That's it. If you compare that to the Muslims, every one of these Muslims was attending mosque. And was regularly going to their mosque and was welcomed by the Islamic community. Whereas the people that have been pulled up for and accused of far-right terrorism, they've had nothing to do with the far-right. At best, they've come across it in the last month, such as Darren Osborne, who Mark Rowley again then speaks about. And I'm not sure if this was at the same speech or not, but this took place this week as well, just before he left. And again, this is really concerning. This is the anti-terrorism chief for Britain, who is just putting out this hysterical propaganda against the far right and nothing about Islamic terrorism. And this is what he said. He said, there is no doubt that far-right material posted online by the likes of Tommy Robinson and Britain First drove the Finsbury Park terror attacker to target Muslims, the UK's most senior counter-terror officer has said. Mark Rowley, the outgoing assistant commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, said Darren Osborne, an alcoholic, suicidal, unemployed loner, was vulnerable to radicalisation. Quote, he had grown to hate Muslims largely due to his consumption of large amounts of online far-right material, including, as evidenced at court, statements from former EDL leader Tommy Robinson, Britain First and others, he told an event in London. Osborne had a dysfunctional background and history of alcohol and drug abuse and violence. There can be no doubt that the extremist rhetoric he consumed fed into his vulnerabilities and turned it into violence. So he's not making any mention there of the Islamic terrorism and the raping of young white girls, which is why Darren Osborne said that he did what he did. He's blaming it all on Tommy Robinson for tweeting. Jailing him for life last month, Justice Chima Grubb took aim at, quote, the bile spewed out online from those who aspire to lead the haters, and said there was no justification for violence in response to terror or grooming gangs. You were rapidly radicalized over the internet, encountering and consuming material put out in this country and the USA from those determined to spread hatred of Muslims on the basis of their religion, the judge told Osborne. Over the space of a month or so, your mindset became one of malevolent hatred. Well, there's two things here, isn't there? So there's no justification for violence as a response to terrorism and rape. And then he says, determined to spread hatred of Muslims on the basis of their religion. So it's not on the basis of their behavior. It's not on the basis of the terrorism and the raping of young white girls. It's on the it's on their religion. So does that mean their behavior is accepted? Is it now an accepted part of their religion, do you think?
Right. Well, I mean, what she's basically saying there is that we don't have a right to defend ourselves. That's what she's saying. What she's saying is that, you know, it's like what Justin Trudeau says, you know, kill your enemy. You know, what does he say? Like, kill, you know, if you kill your enemies, they win. Yeah. You know, and it's just like completely ridiculous. What I find utterly baffling about this situation is there's no understanding of the causality of these events. You know, there's no understanding of the fact that if you push somebody enough, eventually they will push back. You know, you can have the weakest kid in the school and you can bully him every single day, and eventually at some point that kid's going to turn around and he is going to whack you in the face and give you a bloody nose. And this is what people don't understand. You can only push people so far. Now, at the moment, we're seeing people like Darren Osborne, people with a dysfunctional background, people with a history of violence, acting out, people who are on the very fringes of our society. But they're naturally the people who are gonna flip out. He's the type of person who you stick him in front of a video game, in front of Call of Duty, and he's gonna flip out eventually. You stick him in front of, you know, you give him access to alcohol and he'll flip out. You know, if you look at his criminal record, you know, how many of his violent incidents were spurred on by alcohol? You know, are you gonna ban alcohol because, you know, it causes people to be violent? No, you're not. So it's utterly flabbergasting, like, why there is this double standard, and why, like, a justice, so somebody who you'd think would be quite an intelligent person, would not be able to see this and would suggest something so stupid as, you know, some guy is motivated purely by, you know, by what he sees on the internet. You know, somebody like Tommy Robinson has a huge online following. Somebody like Rebel Media has a huge online following. Yet, you don't see people who follow Tommy Robinson on Twitter offing Muslims every day. You know what I mean? And it's like, what's good? You know, this is like an extreme example of what happens, but it's not in a vacuum. It's not just a case of, oh, he's read some of Tommy Robinson's tweets and he's gone and done something. It's a case of, there's a large context to this. For a start, you know, as you mention, what about the fact that, you know, it's the actions of Muslims that are triggering this in the beginning? You know, if there wasn't such thing as radical Islamic terrorism, there wouldn't be a Tommy Robinson. There wouldn't be a counter jihad movement. There wouldn't be all of these talking heads on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter talking about the Islamic problem.
This is it. If it wasn't telling the truth, people would see it, wouldn't they? They would say, "Oh well, it wasn't on the news. That didn't happen."
You can't blame. Basically people who are trying to provide a solution to the problem. You can't tackle the symptom. You know, you can't blame the symptoms for the problem. if you look at a disease and you diagnose somebody and you just treat the symptoms, you will never cure the disease. You will only ever mask it. And this is what they're doing with this Islamic problem. You know, they will talk to death about how, oh, you know, Tommy Robinson's terrible, or, you know, some of these other people, Amory Waters, or, you know, Nick Griffin and all these people, oh, they're terrible. They talk about Islam, or, and, you know, they blame all Muslims, you know, and it's like, oh, you know, terrible, terrible, terrible. But guess what? All you're doing by criticizing those people is you're criticizing a symptom of the problem, because these people wouldn't exist they would be complete unknowns if the Islamic problem didn't exist in the first place.
Yeah, there'd be nothing for them to report upon. It's in the very word there, isn't it? Counter jihad. It's a response to something. That's what it is. Okay, well, moving on from that, after hearing everything that the anti-terror chief had to say about this and the hysteria that he was whipping up, we then had the Hope Not Hate State of Hate 2018 report, which came out. And we're going to look at that. We're going to go into that. And I don't know if it was a coincidence or not, but there's 88 pages in all of this this rag. And it's put out by Hope Not Hate, which is Nick Lowles and Matthew Collins. And Matthew Collins, who is apparently a spy in the far right originally, he was a member of various far right groups and fed back information and caused lots of damage. And then when he retired from being a double agent, he set up shop with Nick Lowles as Hope Not Hate. And the UK Column have reported on this recently. And they've dug up information on the Quilliam Foundation, which is basically the Islamic version of Hope Not Hate. And that is also run by an ex-spy. That's run by an ex-Islamic spy that was a member of the Islamic terror networks and then decided to renounce terrorism. And the government gave them all this funding to set up the Quilliam Foundation. So you have the Quilliam Foundation on one hand, and then you have Hope Not Hate on the other. And they're both fronts for the government, I would suggest, and for the intelligence agencies. And you have a crossover between the people that work for Hope Not Hate and the intelligence agencies. And one of the in particular things in this piece of propaganda against white people, they call violent attacks by people in balaclavas with weapons, they call that disruption. You know, the attack on the Southwest Forum meeting last year took place in January, which where there was, I don't know, 10, 11 Antifa with balaclavas on, throwing rocks through windows with a motorcycle chain, attacking elderly men. And they were given a good thumping as well. They would have required some hospitalization treatment. But, that is a terrorist attack, attacking people masked up with weapons. The security guard on the door said they had murder in mind. They were looking to kill somebody. And this is just reported by Hope Not Hate as being disruption. And because of this disruption, Julie Lake has protection from the police, basically, because of this. And yet the people haven't been arrested. Nothing's been done about it. And yet this was blatantly terrorism. The report itself reads like a gossip magazine, like something that you would pick up in the supermarket. And the first quote that I've got from it dovetails in with what we've just been talking about here. But first off, it says, organisationally, the movement is weaker than it has been for 25 years. That means the nationalist movement. Membership of far-right groups is down to an estimated 600 to 700 people. Traditional far-right parties like the BNP and the National Front are now almost extinct. Yet, at the same time, far-right groups' membership being down to an absolute minimum, yet at the same time, the far-right poses a bigger threat in terms of violence and promotion of its vile views, particularly anti-Muslim views, than it has in many years. The threat is evolving. As traditional British far-right groups collapse, far-right-inspired terrorism is on the rise. Replacing the old-fashioned racial nationalism is anti-Muslim hatred. Today's key activists tend to be younger, operate online, and have little of the obvious Nazi baggage. And then they list some of the people responsible for this far-right inspired terrorism, inspired by today's key activists who tend to be younger, operate online, and have little of the obvious Nazi baggage. And just about all of them are middle-aged and don't actually have any internet presence whatsoever. We've got listed, we've got Darren Osborne, 47 years of age, who ran a Muslim over. He had no social media presence. When he was caught, he had his daughter's smartphone on him, and he'd been following Tommy Robinson on there for a month. Thomas Mayer isn't actually listed on their list, but he's the guy that killed Joe Cox. He was 52 years old, and he has no social media presence whatsoever. Don't even know if he used the internet. Sean Crichton is someone else that they list. He's 45, and he did make some posts on social media. Marek Zakrocki, 48, he drove into a curry house, and the judge actually said, these events are the result of you having drunk up to 2 bottles of wine, which you knew would affect you seriously because of your chronic alcoholism. So this is a crime that took place due to somebody being drunk. This isn't far-right terrorism. They've got Liam Seabrook, someone who is 31 years old, and he's been jailed just for texts. Oh, and that's Sean Crichton, 45. He was jailed just for posts on social media as well. And then they mention Ethan Stables, who is really the only young person on there that fits their description of younger and operate online. And his plot was foiled by Facebook posts. And apparently it was people in his Facebook group that reported him that said, look, this guy is threatening to carry out violence. So, you know, it may even have been nationalists.
Probably other far-right people.
Yeah, other far-right people that foiled that plot. But all of the others, you know, they don't fit this description of young activists or organized people in any way. These are just outliers of society that are frustrated, and the government and Hope Not Hate are drawing tenuous links to nationalists and nationalist organizations and trying to whip up this hysteria because of it. But it does get me that they say the membership of far-right groups has never been lower, and yet then they talk about this huge threat that the far-right poses, and they go through various British nationalist organisations, and every one of them, they just say, oh, they're not going anywhere, they're going to have a terrible 2018, oh, they're completely useless. And yet at the same time, they are hyping up this far-right threat. It really doesn't make any sense. And the fact that they're able to put this out, I mean, it shows that the amount of funding that they've got to put out this propaganda. I think we can actually see where some of the funding comes from. At the end of it, there's a big piece trying to rehabilitate George Soros in there. What are your thoughts about this, about trying to say that today's key activists are the ones that are the ones we have to watch, when it's actually these older nutters that have actually carried out violence? What do you think about this, Alex?
It's the boomer generation. They're the ones who are going to be strapping them, you know, bombs to themselves, you know, not the young'uns. The young people have too much to live for, you know. But what I think is quite interesting here is the paradox between, you know, as you mentioned, the organized far right, the traditional far right groups, they're on their knees, they've got a lower membership than they've ever had before, and they just seem to be sort of stagnating and dissipating into the ether, whereas at the same time, apparently, the far right is more violent and has a wider reach than it's ever had before. And I guess it's true that a lot of these older groups, they are stagnating. They are really, you know, in 5 years' time, they're not going to be around. And at the moment, they just, you know, they're not a threat. They're not anything. They're nothing. But what they're worried about is the far right in this country is restructuring. And yes, new people are emerging, new activists are emerging, people involved in various podcasts, people who are putting out content on the internet, people who run these Facebook pages and all this sort of thing. It might seem a little bit farcical to some people, you know, oh, these people, they just put out memes and whatever. But eventually, remember what happened in America? It started off, this alt-right movement started off mostly focused around podcasts and meme pages on pages that put out funny pictures. And now, look at all of the real-life organisations that have sprung up over the past 24 months. Look at all of the demonstrations they've had. Look at the street activities that are still ongoing. You know, even in the past 3 months, groups like Identity Europa, Traditionalist Workers Party, Patriot Front, all of these groups have put out a tremendous amount of propaganda, even in the past 3 months. Now, I think we're at the point where we're beginning to see a similar kind of movement emerge in the UK. It'll have a different dynamic to it, and it will come about in a different sort of way, and it will have to attune itself to a different cultural milieu, because obviously Britain is very different to the United States. But you've got podcasts, you've got these content creators, people like Millennial Woes, and you've got basically places where people can gravitate towards. You know, around Millennial Woes, he has these Skype groups, these Discords, he attends these conferences. People gather around him, people network around him. And I don't think anything is going to come from, you know, Millennial Woes, or there's a new alt-right podcast called Radio Albion. There's also a people like Zurius, the guy who creates the music. I don't think that they are going to really take it upon themselves to become leaders as such, but it's what happens around them. It's what can come from people sort of, you know, saying, oh, you listen to this? Oh, I like that too. Or, oh, you know, you like that podcast? Oh, I like that podcast too. It's what can come from out of that. And all of the people who are listening to that are very, very young. You know, we're talking between the ages of 16 to 25, that sort of age range. And it's those people who, you know, they're Generation Rent, the generation who, after they graduate university, will not get graduate level jobs. They're the people who really the system can't kind of dangle a carrot in front of and go, well, if you just be a good guy, you're going to, you know, we'll give you a good job, you'll get a nice house, and you'll have a nice fancy BMW or an Audi even. You know, they can't do that. And so for these anti-racist organizations, they can't afford to be seen as irrelevant. You know, they can't afford for the far right to be seen as irrelevant and have their funding cut, because there's a personal reason. They don't want their pensions to be taken away, and they don't want their cushy lifestyle to be taken away. And also, if these people take their foot off the gas and they stop monitoring the far right, if they stop monitoring the evolving nature of the far right, they will not be able to, when this thing that's currently almost entirely based on the internet starts emerging in the real world, they will not be able to counter it. They will not have been able to keep tabs on it. And because it's in such a state of flux, it's very hard to keep, you know, it's changing all the time. It's very nebulous and very difficult for somebody who doesn't have their finger on the pulse to understand. And this is what I think they're trying to get at. Because if you're an activist these days, and you've got a Twitter following, or you've got a Facebook page, or if you're on Gab or Minds or YouTube, if you wanted to, you could mobilize people at the drop of a hat. Some like Mark Collett, if he wanted to, he could mobilize a fair number of people around him. Lots of people watch his videos, lots of people follow him on Twitter. He's got about 5,000 Facebook friends. He could potentially do quite a lot if he wanted to, if he set his mind to doing something in the real world.
Definitely. So
they've got to keep an eye on that, and I think that's why they're sort of very worried.
Well, so you're almost talking that it's you know, the equivalent of membership in these organisations years ago, like membership in the BNP. In the BNP, it's now followers. I mean, Millennial Woe's got over 20,000 followers, 25,000 followers. You know, that's a lot of people. Especially for a British nationalist voice to have all those people listening to him and subscribing to the channel. And you know, there's probably 10 times as many people as that actually listening to him. That's just people that click the subscribe button I never used to click the subscribe button on YouTube. I used to listen to all this stuff. It's only fairly recently I started subscribing to people. And I'm sure there must be a lot of people like me that are the same, that just listen to this stuff, but don't think to actually click that subscribe button. Only 1%, less than 1% of our listeners actually comment. You know, so you just by the number of subs, it's going to be a lot more people that are listening to it, and it's the tweets and the Facebook. And yes, it is important. You know, I agree with you, Alex. There, but one of the funniest things in this report is that they don't seem to understand why it is that people have so many followers from their tweets. They just don't understand what it was that got Tommy Robinson all his followers. They've got a whole page talking about it where they're blaming tweets instead of terrorism. As part of Hope Not Hate's Islamophobia report, we conducted an investigation into the responses to terrorist attacks on social media. We looked at social media accounts of prominent anti-Muslim and far-right activists in the UK, as well as abroad, and observed that most of them grew significantly during the whole year. I wonder why. More notably, these raised profiles did not grow at a steady pace throughout the year, but in short bursts to gain new followers and increased resonance in the hours and days after the terror attacks. They were consistently among the most mentioned and shared social media users on these topics. Tommy Robinson, the former EDL leader and the most prominent anti-Muslim activist in the UK, almost tripled his number of followers during the year. Part of the reason for his increased exposure can be attributed to his move to Canadian far-right alternative media outlet Rebel Media, and his distancing himself from earlier street activism, which inevitably increased his respectability and exposure. But the career shift itself does not explain how he added as many as 40,000 new followers just in the week after the Manchester attack. What could it be, Alex? The same pattern can be seen among other anti-Muslim accounts on Twitter. Terror attacks were followed by outbursts of anti-Muslim sentiment on Twitter, and the activity of far-right accounts spiked along with their number of followers. The influence of the big far-right accounts on Twitter is easily seen in the case of the London Bridge attack. Out of the top 100 most shared tweets about the attack, 32 showed clearly negative sentiments about Muslims. It couldn't possibly be Muslim terrorism that is actually increasing the number of followers to Tommy Robinson's Twitter account. It couldn't possibly be that. It must be something else. It must be his career shift, or it must be him joining Rebel Media. No, it can't possibly actually be Muslims causing
this collection of Stone Island
sentiment.
Jackets.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's absolutely blind, aren't they? They cannot see that it's the Muslims themselves that are causing this sentiment against them. And it couldn't be more obvious than that. You know, there's a huge spike in their graft right after the terrorism. But no, it can't be the Muslims that caused the interest in Tommy Robinson. I mean, it just bears out what you were saying, Alex.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, there's a hell of a lot of anger out there about what's happening to our country. A lot of ordinary people aren't thinking, you know, oh, it's all fine, you know, everything's hunky-dory. A lot of people are very, very angry at what is going on in our country, but they're also very, very scared. They're paralyzed with fear, and they will not articulate what they, you know, what their feelings are. But who does? And on Twitter, they can go and they can find people like Tommy Robinson and all these other types who do speak out. You know, you look at somebody like, what's her name? The woman who used to be like a Daily Mail columnist, but now has moved over to Rebel Media.
Katie Hopkins,
that's the one.
Yeah.
She's somebody who's very outspoken. But I don't actually like Katie Hopkins that much. I think she's quite a detestable woman. But actually, because she's so outspoken, people will follow her. She has a following because of that, because she taps into something that people are feeling, you know, and this is something that seems to be completely just these anti-racist organizations, they miss the point completely. They don't seem to understand that actually when things like this are happening, that there is going to be a reaction, that people aren't just going to think, oh, well, you know, it's only a couple, you know, it's only one or two. It doesn't work like that. And I think that, you know, as time goes on, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens, because one of the things that they mentioned in this report was because the far right organizationally is a weak point, where its strength is now is in social media, that the government should almost be taking more action to curtail the far right on social media and on the internet. What does that mean? In reality, that means censorship. That's the only effective way you're going to be able to curtail people's voices on these platforms. So what does that mean for the government? Does that mean if these people get their way, that the government is going to start introducing more and more repressive legislation governing what we say and what we can, and what we can write?
That's just going to anger people all the more. I mean, Katie Hopkins, I think I'm really encouraged by her. She gets further and further towards where we are every year. And I've been watching her go from just being a contestant on The Apprentice to talking about Muslim grooming gangs, to talking about the white race, to standing up for white people in South Africa. She gets more and more radical as every year passes. And as you say, she's giving a voice to the majority that don't have a voice. And the fact that she is getting more and more radical says that the majority is getting more and more radical. Because she's like a gauge of what people think. They've really got it in for you in this, Alex, talking about voices of people.
Can I just mention one thing about the South Africa thing as well? Because obviously this week, the South African government passed that law, which will see the confiscation of more farmland from the white Boer farmers. At the moment, Lauren Southern has gone over to South Africa, and she's released a documentary with the help of Caelan Robertson, who's the gay Irish boy who used to hang out with Tommy Robinson. I think the South Africa issue is going to be a big one this year. I think the awareness of that among the general public is going to reach huge proportions, unprecedented proportions. I remember a couple of years ago, you know, we went out into the streets and we did, you know, activism on this, you know, demonstrations to try and raise awareness of this. And very few ordinary people knew what was going on. I think now, 4 years later, I think we're going to see a lot more people aware of what's going on in South Africa. And people are going to realize that what happens in South Africa is what happens when you become a minority, when you were once the governing majority in a country.
Yeah, I think Katie Hopkins has done a really good job, actually, at exposing that. It was, all seemed to time to coincide with this big land grab. I did mentioned that in a podcast last week. I forget which one it was. Anyway, yeah, moving on to the next issue, and that's you yourself, Alex.
I got a mention. I got my own page even.
An entire page devoted to you. They had another page linking you to National Action and trying to pretend that National Action was still going. So here's your chance to respond to what they had to say about you, Alex.
Yes. Well, where do I begin? Where do I begin? Because, right, first off, you have this allegation that I went and founded this System Resistance Network. Now, I've mentioned the SRN, the System Resistance Network, on here previously, because we did a podcast and we were sort of talking about the various options that people had. One of the options that people have is to join a group like Generation Identity, which is a very kind of above ground group that talks about, you know, opposition to mass immigration, but doesn't talk about, you know, the JQ isn't openly National Socialist, this sort of thing. And you have another group like the SRN, which is openly National Socialist, and is the propaganda they put out. It even makes me blush. Honestly, some of the stuff they put out really is, you know, I'll be honest, it is over the line, legally speaking, I would say. And if you were caught putting it out, you'd probably get into quite a bit of trouble. But all in all, you know, I think the fact that, you know, they're putting out a solid National Socialist message is really, you know, is really good. But unfortunately, because of my situation, which, as people don't know, if they want to know more about my situation, then go to the episode where we talked about the raids around National Action and the ongoing investigation into this, into another Nazi phantom that they've created, this idea that there's this group that has continued after the prescription and is apparently, even though they've now got more of us on remand at the moment, then turned up to some of the demonstrations when National Action was a legal organization, is apparently even more active than it was than when it was legal to operate under. Now,
most bizarre.
It is most bizarre. But because of that, I've basically said, you know, there's no point in me being involved in any kind of activism. There's no point in me being involved in any kind of groups or organizations, whether it's Generation Identity, whether it's System Resistance Network, whether it's the National Front or the London Forum or any of these groups, because of all of the heat that's on me at the moment, there's no point, because I just attract too much attention.
Well, that's why you're here, isn't it? That's why you're doing podcasts. You know, you're doing podcasts instead of activism.
That's why we do a podcast, yeah. Because it's a way that I can still get a message out, but I'm not attached to anyone. I'm not part of anything. And, you know, I can still give shout outs, you know, and I think Hope Not Hate have, you know, I wasn't going to do this, but Hope Not Hate have forced my hand now. If you want to go and find out more about the SRN, go to gab.ai/SR network and you can find out all about the SRN. Go there, listeners, and have a look for yourself. And I'm sure you'll be very entertained by what you find.
So you're not the you're not the criminal mastermind behind it then.
Well, you know, no comment. But you know, at the end of the day, you know, the police are all over my communications, all over my bank accounts. If I was involved in anything, they'd be well aware of it and they would come down at me like a ton of bricks. So to think that I would then go and found another organization is absolutely stupid. You know, after what happened with National Action, there is no point. The eye of Sauron is upon me, you know. What is the point? There are other ways that I can get the message out without putting myself at, you know, ridiculous personal risk, you know. And there's another thing here that they mention as well, and this is basically a distortion of what we've mentioned before in other podcasts, and that is, you know, they talk about how, oh, I'm actively encouraging my supporters to target opponents, especially female MPs. Fuck off. I'm not saying to target female MPs. What are you on about? What that suggests is, what that reads like is like I'm suggesting, oh, go after these female MPs because they're weak and, you know, you can easily intimidate them. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, when you have an MP in a constituency who lets down their constituents, and you mentioned Tracy Brabin, who is the MP for Batley and Spen, is in a constituency where grooming gangs exist, they operate, and she isn't talking about them. She isn't speaking out in Parliament about the hideous nature, the hideous crimes that are taking place against our vulnerable girls. Yeah, she isn't doing anything. And so, as an MP, she is open to scrutiny. She's a public figure. And if nationalists wanted to direct a campaign against Tracy Babin and ask her directly, why is it, Tracy, that you are not standing up for your constituents and looking out for them and their interests, that is perfectly reasonable. Direct action is perfectly reasonable. It is perfectly justifiable and it is legitimate. There are lots of direct action groups out there. Lots of them are on the left. There's a direct action group in Cardiff that every year turn out to oppose the Cardiff Arms Fair. There's groups in London recently over the cold, during the cold winter spell, who came out and occupied buildings so that homeless people could take shelter in them. That is direct action. There are people like the hunt saboteurs who go out there and they stop fox hunting, illegal fox hunting. There are people who go out there and stop the badger cull every year. That is direct action. Hope Not Hate will not try and make out that these direct action groups on the left are somehow, you know, when they talk about direct action, it's some sort of, there's some sort of double meaning there, or that these groups target vulnerable people. No, they won't do that at all. And what they're doing here is they're trying to make out that I'm some sort of crazy guy who's talking about, you know, doing violent actions and all these types of things. That is such a distortion of what I'm saying. Whenever I talk about things, whenever I encourage people to take action, to stop complaining and stop feeling like a victim all the time, stop being paralyzed by fear and actually go out there and organize and do something, I what I'm doing is I'm encouraging positive action. I'm encouraging people to empower themselves. That can't be considered a bad thing. Only people who have a problem with ordinary British people standing up for themselves would take issue with that. Obviously, Hope have taken an issue with that, so you can make your own conclusions, can't you?
Well, I think we were responding to some left-wing direct action at the time. That I think that was the conversation that we were having when you said the nationalists need to target some of the MPs for direct action. You know, I think that's what it was in response to.
Yeah, Mayor, Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yeah, that was it. That was it. It was when the left went after Jacob Rees-Mogg, and you said I think you know, nationalists should get involved in direct action against MPs that are obviously speaking out against us. But they do their hardest to put national action on every page in this report. They're just desperate to create this phantom menace that you've been mentioning, Alex, and they're constantly linking you with it and saying that you've been setting up all these other organizations as well. So that seems
I've been busy boy, haven't I?
Yeah, really busy. I don't have the time to do all of this and organize all of this. And as you say, there's more people in prison that than turned up for these demonstrations, and none of them have been actually convicted of anything. There's never been any conviction for any violence associated with national action. And the alleged terrorist offences are stickers and documents found on a hard drive. And there's this allegation of a plot to kill an MP, which is so ludicrous. It is obviously just the beer talking, basically. And it's one of these Hope Not Hate spies.
What happens when... You know, I defy anyone to go into a pub on a Saturday, and you know, if there are always people talking crap in the pub on a Saturday, you know, once the drinks have been going. And honestly, you know, I hear more I often hear more revolutionary talk in my local Wetherspoons than I do at nationalist gatherings, to be honest.
It's quite a common thing. Go on.
And there's one other thing here they mention as well, you know, as we're on the topic of our lads who are on remand at the moment. They say, you know, they mention that I've become more brazen and open, direct, and, you know, I've got to, you know, the authorities need to act now on my incendiary rhetoric, you know. But guess what? The reason why I feel duty bound to keep speaking out, to you know, create this podcast. I don't have to create this podcast. You know, it's a Sunday. I you know, when we record these, I could be out, you know, doing other things, you know. But the reason why I feel duty bound to keep doing what we're doing is because there are good lads out there who are currently deprived of their freedom for absolutely nothing. They have been robbed of their voice. And I'm one of the lucky ones. I am one of the very lucky ones who still have a voice, who can still speak out. And I would be letting down good, patriotic, decent lads who have given their all for our race, who have showed more balls than most other people in this country, the vast majority of people in this country. So when Hope Not Hate talk about, you know, oh, he's become, you know, this and that, the only people you have to blame is yourselves and the repressive system that you have helped create, this atmosphere of suppression that you've helped create. You know, what do you expect when you're locking up people? You're forcing people into a corner. You're forcing people to keep, you know, honestly, there are times where I think to myself, you know, I was thinking, you know, when I first read this, you know, should I, you know, maybe pack it in a little bit? Should I, you know, maybe, you know, cut down on the podcasts, you know, maybe call it a day? Unfortunately, what you do when you criticize somebody like this, you have the opposite effect. You don't make them want to think, oh, let's give it up, you know, oh, what's the point, you know. You make them think, well, there is a point, because these people are taking notice. These people seem to be concerned about what we're putting out here. And you know, there's that saying, if you're taking flak, you must be over the target.
Yeah, you do. You definitely are over the target, I think. And, you know, I'm really glad that we can give you a platform here. And, you know, you've got to speak up for these people that have been deprived of their voice and that are in prison on trumped up charges. And the charges about the plot to murder an MP, I mean, they were brought about by this very organisation, Hope Not Hate, paying for a spy to infiltrate the group. And, you know, looking through the pages, they run down every organization in Britain and they run the organizations down and they say, oh, they're not doing anything. And they also do their best to create gossip and infighting among them. They've obviously got spies embedded in these organizations to come out with a lot of the information that they've got there. Either that, or they're just making stuff up to try and create fights. I mean, they try to say, oh, there's friction between Paul Golding and Jada Franson and they're going to fall out. And it's basically trying to, I don't know if there is friction there or not, but if there is, that they're trying to increase it to get them to fight amongst one another. With the National Front, it says, and this is a quote from there, the party is now bracing itself for a hostile takeover by a joint London Forum and National Action Initiative blindly led by Bristol's Julie Lake. Julie's never had anything to do with National Action. Not even
these National Action chaps, they get around, don't they?
Yeah, they're into everything.
Really, the way they go on, it's as if, you know, this National Action organisation is doing more now than they ever did before.
Well, this, you know, how can they be a joint London Forum and National Action Initiative? This is completely made up, and it's just been put in there to try and cause eruptions, try and cause trouble, yeah. Try and cause suspicion, isn't it?
Divide and rule is the method of attack, I think.
Yeah, Julie Lake's never been involved with National Action. She's a part of the National Front anyway. And the London Forum is non-partisan. It welcomes anyone from any organisation if they're nationalist. So this is just a nonsense. It's just put in there to try and, as you say, just divide and rule. And finally, when we get to the end of this document, we get, I mean, this is the most bizarre thing. You get two pages defending George Soros. Two whole pages defending George Soros. It really couldn't be any clearer who it is that's funding Hope Not Hate, as well as the government and as well as these others. And basically they say in it that because George Soros is Jewish, any criticism of George Soros means that it's anti-Semitism. They don't actually try to refute any of the claims that people have made. And this is some of what they write. They write, it is no surprise that Soros and the Open Society Foundation have won the enmity of the right. He has openly supported progressive causes such as LGBT rights, support for refugees, and the defence of human rights, and many of the organisations and individuals that OSF funds seek to build more open and tolerant societies based on progressive and democratic values. That's quite clearly Hope Not Hate, isn't it? And they say George Soros, there's a Telegraph headline, George Soros, the man who broke the Bank of England, backing secret plot to thwart Brexit. And that was a headline in the Telegraph. But according to Hope Not Hate, that's anti-Semitic. They say such ugly prejudice coming from any quarters is always worrying. But the fact that this anti-Soros conspiracy theory has broken out of the confines of the political fringe and begun to gain mainstream traction is a real cause for concern. I mean, this guy, Soros, is he, millionaire, billionaire? He's got so much money, and yet he needs this organization to defend him and put two whole pages into defending the guy. It's quite clearly that he's involved with it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Hope Not Hate. I was watching I was listening to an interview that Matthew Collins gave with a talk show on BBC Ulster. And he raises, the question of George Soros was raised. And what does Matthew Collins do? He says, George Soros, is a good guy. You know, his Open Society Foundation pays for incubators for premature babies in Hungary. You know, no talk of the political motivations behind the Open Society Foundation. No talk about the fact that George Soros made his billions by basically betting against Britain when we left the European exchange rate mechanism, and which triggered Black Monday, I think it was, or Black Wednesday. And it's very interesting, because at the end of the day, he who pays the piper decides the tune. And I think if you follow the money trail, you'll find that certain anti-Brexit, pro-Remain campaigns have been tied to people like Nick Lowles and people attached to the Hope Not Hate organization have also links to George Soros funded groups. And so you can see there is, if you follow the money, you'll find that, George Soros's hand is there somewhere behind the scenes.
Well, it just proves it, doesn't it? I mean, it's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that he funds these groups, and here you are, you've got this group blatantly shilling for George Soros. It just proves it, doesn't it? That he's involved in these groups and getting them to pay, funding them. Groups like Black Lives Matter. Hungary has said that he's an enemy of the state. They had to shut down his university that he was funding because it was just churning out other little enemies to the state. And yet here you've got Hope Not Hate just saying what a wonderful guy he is and how it's all a conspiracy theory that he's funding these groups. Yeah, it's quite bizarre. Have you got anyone else that you'd like to plug before we finish, Alex? You'd like to plug your secret organization once again before we finish?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, I've got my finger in so many pies these days. As they mentioned, there's the coup of the National Front that we've got going on at the moment, and there's the Death Star that we're constructing as well. That's going very, very well. But no, there are lots of bits and pieces happening, but I think, I can't think of anything else that's really going on at the moment. Bodicea Events. Should we plug Bodicea Events? Because I think they've got an event coming up in April with Pierre Rushton speaking and a few other people.
I'm not sure of the date for that yet. Yeah, you have to tell me about that once we've finished. And we've got Alison Shablow on as well on Monday, but I guess people will be listening to this after that's actually been on air. Don't forget, we do have a Bitcoin wallet and we do require donations to keep the radio station going. We'll be back next Monday with more RA Britannia for you. Thanks for coming on, Alex. And thank you very much, listeners, for listening. And we hope you all have a great week ahead of you.
Listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.